Welcome to the reading of the New York Times for Tuesday, June 6, 2023. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. The New York Times is donated to Radio Eye by the Lexington Herald Leader. Your reader for today is Dawn Flickinger. We'll start today's reading with the Merriam-Webster Word of the Day. Trenchant. T-R-E-N-C-H-A-N-T. Trenchant. It's an adjective. Trenchant is a formal word that is usually used to describe communication that is notably strong, clear, and perceptive, or in other words, sharp. The author's trenchant wit was very evident in the critique she wrote of the much acclaimed film. Trenchant insights, made eloquently by the speaker, clearly affected many of those in the audience. There's much to know about the word trenchant, but we'll cut to the chase. The word trenchant comes from the Anglo-French verb trencher, meaning to cut. Hence, a trenchant sword is one with a keen edge. Nowadays, trenchant mostly describes things that don't cut deeply literally, but that are still felt. A trenchant remark is one that cuts close to the bone, and a trenchant observation is one that cuts to the heart of the matter. In addition to meaning caustic and sharply perceptive, trenchant also carries a sense meaning very strong, clear, and effective that may be used, for instance, to describe a persuasive essay written with intellectual rigor. If you find yourself forgetting these edgy definitions, you might dig up a familiar relative of trenchant, the noun trench, which refers to a long cut or ditch in the ground. Schools received billions in stimulus funds. It may not be doing enough. Pandemic aid was supposed to help students recover from learning loss, but results have been mixed. By Madeline Nago. When the pandemic shut down schools across the country, the federal government responded with billions of dollars to help districts support remote learning, serve free meals to students, and safely reopen schools. In 2021, the Biden administration gave districts another $122 billion through its $1.9 trillion stimulus package, an amount that far surpasses the previous rounds. Districts were required to spend at least 20% of those funds on helping students recover academically, while the rest could be used on general efforts to respond to the pandemic. Yet while most schools have since deployed various forms of interventions, and some have spent more on academic recovery than others, there are ample signs that the money has not been spent in a way that has substantially helped all of the nation's students lagging behind. Recent test scores underscore the staggering effect of the pandemic, which thrust much of the nation's students into remote learning for extended periods of time. Students in most states and across almost all demographic groups experienced major setbacks in math and reading after many schools closed their doors. In 2022, math scores underwent the largest declines ever recorded on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which tests a broad sampling of fourth and eighth graders dating back to the early 1990s. Education researchers and advocates say recovering from the effects of remote learning should be the top priority, but it is unclear how much of the funding is helping students across the nation fully catch up. Plans for the relief funds have varied across the country. Some districts have invested more in extended learning time or offering intensive small group tutoring focused on math or English, which research has shown to be among the most powerful interventions. Others have used much of their funds on facility upgrades, online tutoring services, across-the-board bonuses for employees, and other measures that education experts have argued are less effective for helping students catch up. National data on how the money has been spent is scarce. The federal government does limited tracking of the relief funds, which were sent directly to states. Many states, which dole out the money to districts, do not provide detailed breakdowns of expenditures. Some education experts who have closely monitored the relief money said the federal guidelines should have been more focused on addressing learning loss, and were skeptical that many districts' recovery plans were robust enough. Although schools were initially slow to spend the money, they are now on track to exhaust the funding by the September 2024 deadline for budgeting the money. Robin Lake, the director of the Center on Reinventing Public Education, said the impact of the funding has been a bit of a black box, and she expected to see different recovery rates across districts. Ms. Lake said giving across-the-board bonuses, completing maintenance projects, and plugging the holes in budgets were less effective interventions. In some districts, I think we're going to see that the money was well spent, Ms. Lake said, and in many, maybe most, it won't have been spent as well as it should have been in terms of addressing the urgent need right in front of us. She pointed to data showing that many students still did not have access to the kind of intensive tutoring programs that have proved effective, with demonstrated large positive effects on math and reading achievement. A federal survey conducted in December found that most public schools offered some form of tutoring, but only 37% provided students more intensive high-dosage tutoring, which is typically done in smaller groups, takes place for at least 30 minutes, and includes at least 3 sessions a week. Out of all public schools, just 10% of the students participated in that type of tutoring. Early reports show that schools have had difficulty setting up academic recovery programs. A recent paper from Harvard University's Center for Education Policy Research found that schools struggled last year to carry out recovery programs at their intended scale because of staffing shortages and lower student engagement. The researchers, who sampled 12 districts, found that some of the estimated effects were positive, but even if the programs were fully set up, they would still not be enough to help all students catch up by 2024. Thomas Kane, the center's facility director and co-author of the papers, said implementation has since improved but remains far below the necessary levels. He expected to see some gains this year but said a significant gap will remain, since not enough schools were extending the academic year or placing most students in summer school. Every district can describe how they're spending the money, Mr. Kane said, but few, if any, districts have a recovery plan that's specially sized to their students' losses. Education department officials said they were confident much of the stimulus money was being spent on academic recovery. The department's ongoing technical assistance and communication with states indicate that investments in academic recovery, staffing, and student mental health comprise the majority of local spending, Adam Schott, a deputy assistant secretary, said in a statement. Sasha Pudaleski, a director at AASA, the School Superintendents Association, said districts were prioritizing spending on additional learning time, according to July data from AASA. 68% of districts were spending some funds on expanded summer learning, 42% were adding learning time by compensating staff, and 39% were providing high-intensity tutoring. In Tennessee, 87 districts are participating in a program that provides matching grants using federal dollars to districts offering small group tutoring in reading or math. One of the participating districts, Elizabethton City Schools, hired 14 full-time staff members to administer English language arts tutoring to 404 elementary and middle school students this year. Students attended sessions during the school day twice a week for 45 minutes each. Myra Newham, the assistant director for Schools for Academics, said the district was spending 56% of its $5.6 million in relief funds on academic recovery. The district has already seen significant gains. In 2022, 45.6% of 3rd to 8th graders were proficient in English, up from 33.9% in 2021 and 43% in 2019. Most of our money went towards students and closing the gap in learning loss, Ms. Newman said. Other districts have spent more relief funds on facility upgrades. Researchers at Georgetown University's Edenomics Lab estimate that a quarter of the last round of relief funds would be spent on facilities. Oregon's Klamath County School District plans to use about 30% of its $16.1 million federal share on academic recovery programs and 70% on facilities projects. Those include buying new turf fields, replacing HVAC systems, upgrading flooring, renovating bleachers and baseball fields, constructing a gym, and surfacing an elementary school parking lot. Glenn Sasmaniak, the district superintendent, said the projects would help improve student safety and wellness. Some bleachers had nails popping up and boards that were cracking. Without a new turf field, some students would not have a place to play during recess, and one of the football teams would need to travel half an hour to practice. Officials chose not to spend the funds on hiring staff because the money would eventually run out. We would have to fire them in 3 or 4 years. It's not a way to treat people. Officials instead tapped millions in annual state funding to hire reading specialists, add counselors, and expand small group and project-based instruction. Mr. Sasmaniak said has already led to improved proficiency in math among elementary school students this year, according to early assessments. Last year, 36% of third graders met state grade level expectations for English, down from 42% in 2019. Wisconsin's Cudahy School District is spending about 80% of its $4.7 million in relief funds on facilities upgrades and 20% on academic recovery, which includes professional development for staff members and employing literacy specialists. Among the district's third graders, 29.8% were proficient in reading in 2022, up from 23.6% in 2021 and down from 35.9% in 2019. Tina Owen Moore, the district superintendent, said officials were worried about sustaining salaries, so they spent more on upgrading HVAC systems and remodeling classrooms to allow for social distancing. If we only did high-dosage tutoring while we had those funds there, well, as soon as those funds go away, we wouldn't be able to continue to support students, Ms. Owens Moore said. Marguerite Rosa, the director of the Edonomics Lab, said some facility projects, like new HVAC systems, were reasonable, but others, such as parking lot renovations, would not do much to help students catch up. Although she said she wanted to see improved academic recovery efforts, she did not expect many districts to revise their plans. With the looming funding deadline and steep enrollment declines expected to hurt some districts' budgets, she said officials were more focused on preventing school closures and wide layoffs. Pretty quickly, they're starting to panic, Ms. Rosa said. There's less and less energy on how to leverage these limited dollars. SEC accuses Binance of mishandling funds and lying to regulators. The SEC said the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange mixed billions of dollars in customer funds and secretly sent them to a separate company controlled by Binance's founder, Changpeng Zhao. By Matthew Goldstein, Emily Flitter, and David Yoff Bellany. The Securities and Exchange Commission on Monday accused Binance, the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange, of mishandling customer funds and lying to American regulators and investors about its operations, in a sweeping case that has the potential to remake the landscape of power and wealth within crypto. The SEC's lawsuit was the second time this year that federal regulators have accused Binance of evading laws designed to protect investors in the United States. Regulators have long seen the exchange, which has said it does $65 billion in average daily trading volume, as a major target in their quest to bring to heel a crypto industry that has been built around an explicitly anti-government ethos. In the 136-page complaint, the SEC said Binance had mixed billions of dollars in customer funds and secretly sent them to a separate company, Merit Peak Limited, which is controlled by Binance's founder, Changpeng Zhao. The complaint also said Binance had misled investors about the adequacy of its systems to detect and control manipulative trading and about its efforts to restrict U.S. users from trading on its international platform. U.S.-based customers were supposed to have access only to an ostensibly separate company formed specifically to operate within the United States, called Binance U.S. Binance and Mr. Zhao enriched themselves by billions of U.S. dollars while placing investors' assets at significant risk, regulators said in the civil lawsuit, which was filed in federal district court in Washington. In a blog post on Monday, Binance said its leaders had been trying to negotiate a settlement with regulators and were disappointed and disheartened by the SEC's decision to bring a case. The company said the case was a misguided and conscious refusal to provide much-needed clarity and guidance to the digital asset industry, and added that it would fight back vigorously. Binance also charged that the SEC had rushed to court to file the lawsuit, noting that last week regulators had served a new set of 26 document requests to the company. The charges were the latest actions by U.S. regulators and prosecutors to rein in the Wild West of crypto trading and force major players in the space to come into compliance with U.S. laws. Sam Bankman-Fried, the founder of FTX, which has been a big crypto trading rival of Binance's until it filed for bankruptcy in November, faces an October trial for fraud and other charges. In recent months, the SEC has also levied fines and other penalties against crypto lending firms. The SEC has taken the position that most crypto tokens issued by exchanges like Binance and FTX should be treated as securities under federal law. U.S. regulators are putting pretty huge speed bumps for Binance and are continuing to put the crypto world on notice, said Reena Agarwal, a finance professor at Georgetown University. Binance was already under increasing pressure. In March, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission filed its own civil law enforcement action against Binance and Mr. Zhao. The Justice Department is also investigating the exchange for money laundering violations. Binance lost its outside auditing firm late last year, and the company has seen its control of the crypto market shrink. To improve its reputation, Binance has hired new compliance officials, including a former federal prosecutor who now heads its compliance operation. The SEC complaint exposes the underbelly of crypto, and big global exchanges like Binance have misled the public at large for years, said David Silver, a lawyer who has sued Binance several times. In all, the SEC filed 13 charges against Binance and Mr. Zhao, better known in the crypto world as CZ. It is seeking restitution from Binance and wants to bar Mr. Zhao from serving as an officer or director for any registered entity in the United States that issues securities. We allege that Zhao and the Binance entities not only knew the rules of the road, but they also consciously chose to evade them and put their customers and investors at risk, said Gerber Gruel, director of the SEC's Enforcement Division. The CFTC is also seeking to bar Mr. Zhao for life from doing business that falls under its jurisdiction. The agency also wants to permanently banish Binance from the United States. The SEC and CFTC often coordinate the filing of enforcement actions when they are investigating the same company, but the agencies have been engaged in a turf battle to determine which would emerge as the primary regulator of crypto trading. Binance has long been based outside the United States, offering high-risk trading options that are not legal for American customers. In 2019, it started a separate exchange in the United States that offered a smaller array of trading capabilities. The company said that the new exchange, Binance US, would operate separately from Binance under its own leadership. But the SEC said the separate entity was really intended as subterfuge to conceal the fact that Mr. Zhao and his associates were actively enabling U.S. customers to trade on Binance's much larger, unregulated offshore exchange. The SEC's complaint accuses Binance of recruiting American customers to the international exchange, even though it was not supposed to operate in the United States. On the surface, we cannot be seen to have U.S. users, but in reality, we should get them through other creative means, a Binance executive wrote in an internal message excerpted in the complaint. When Binance took steps to submit to a U.S. regulatory regimen, it did so disingenuously, the filing said. Binance U.S. was supposed to be separate from its offshore parent, but behind the scenes, Mr. Zhao and other senior Binance leaders were intimately involved, the complaint said. That led one executive to remark that the entire team feels like they've been duped into being a puppet, according to the complaint. The SEC and Mr. Zhao gave instructions to encourage so-called VIP customers to bypass systems meant to restrict U.S. customers' access to the platform. Binance's plan to retain lucrative U.S. investors while pretending to restrict them was a success, the complaint said. Some of the allegations against Binance echoed the behavior that brought down FTX, leading to criminal charges against Mr. Bankman-Fried for using customers' deposits to conduct other business operations and make political and charitable donations. According to the complaint against Binance, the bank account of Merit Peak, the trading firm controlled by Mr. Zhao, has received more than $20 billion, including customer funds. FTX is accused of having used a trading firm called Alameda Research, controlled by Mr. Bankman-Fried, to improperly divert and use customer money. Sending Binance customer funds to Merit Peak plays those funds at risk, including of loss or theft, and was done without notice to customers, the complaint said. Robert Hansen, FBI agent exposed as spy for Moscow, dies at 79. Mr. Hansen was sentenced to life in prison in 2002, bringing to a close one of the most lurid and damaging espionage cases in American history by Peter Baker. Robert Hansen, a former FBI agent who spied for Moscow off and on for more than two decades during and after the Cold War, in one of the most damaging espionage cases in American history, was discovered dead in his prison cell in Colorado on Monday, federal authorities announced. He was 79. The Federal Bureau of Prisons said in a statement that Mr. Hansen was found unresponsive just before 7 a.m. at the United States Penitentiary, Florence, where he was serving a life sentence. He was pronounced dead after life-saving efforts by emergency medical workers. The statement did not identify a cause. Mr. Hansen's case was considered one of the most notorious spy scandals of his generation, shocking FBI leaders and other government officials when they learned that one of their own had been feeding information to the other side with impunity for so many years. To this day, the FBI describes him as the most damaging spy in Bureau history. In exchange for $1.4 million in cash, bank funds, and diamonds, Mr. Hansen passed along a torrent of secrets to Moscow, including one disclosing that the United States government had dug a tunnel underneath the Soviet embassy in Washington to eavesdrop on diplomatic and other communications. He also informed Moscow about three KGB officers who were secretly spying for the United States, two of whom were later executed. The magnitude of Hansen's crimes cannot be overstated, Paul J. McNulty, who was the U.S. attorney who prosecuted him, said on Monday in response to reports of his death. They will long be remembered as being among the most egregious betrayals of trust in U.S. history. It was both a low point and an investigative success for the FBI. Mr. Hansen's arrest in 2001 briefly ruptured relations between the United States and Russia at a time when the two former enemies were seeking to build friendlier ties after the collapse of the Soviet Union. President George W. Bush expelled about 50 Russian diplomats, and President Vladimir Putin of Russia retaliated with a tit-for-tat expulsion of 50 American diplomats. But both sides were determined to end the matter there and not allow it to result in a more lasting rift. The discovery of Mr. Hansen's espionage embarrassed the FBI and resulted in changes to security procedures. He told investigators after his arrest that security at the Bureau was so lax that it amounted to criminal negligence. He said it was a simple matter to gain access to classified material on official computers with only routine security clearances. Any clerk in the Bureau could come up with stuff on that system, Mr. Hansen said, according to a Justice Department report on his case in 2002. It's criminal what's laid out. Mr. Hansen pleaded guilty to 15 counts of espionage and conspiracy to avoid the death penalty and expressed remorse for his betrayal. I am ashamed by it, he said during the 2002 hearing where he was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Since July 17, 2002, Mr. Hansen has been in custody at Florence, the Supermax facility that is considered the most secure prison in the federal system and used in recent years to house convicted terrorists. Inmates there are typically held in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. Mr. Hansen joined the FBI in 1976 as a special agent and went on to hold several counterintelligence positions that gave him access to classified information. He began spying for the Soviet Union 3 years after joining the Bureau, when he was assigned to a counterintelligence unit in New York by walking into the New York offices of AMTORG, a Soviet trade organization that was known to be a front for the Soviet military intelligence agency. He stopped spying for several years starting in 1980 after his wife Bonnie walked in on him in the basement of their home in Westchester County, New York, and he quickly tried to cover up his papers. He confessed to her and to a priest affiliated with Opus Dei, the conservative Catholic organization to which the couple belonged. In 1985, he began spying again, providing information to the KGB. This time, he did a better job of covering his tracks, using encrypted communications and other secret methods. Even the Russians never knew who he was, identifying himself only by code names like B and Ramon Garcia. Mr. Hansen turned over sensitive information said to include specific satellite intelligence collection capabilities. He stopped spying again after the Soviet Union collapsed, then resumed again in 1999. His betrayal went undetected for years as he collected at least $600,000 in cash and diamonds from the KGB and its post-Soviet successor, SVR, which told him that they had set aside another $800,000 for him in a Moscow bank, according to prosecutors. In the 1990s, after the arrest of Aldrich Ames, a CIA agent who had also spied for the Russians, the FBI and the CIA realized that someone else was still providing Russia with classified information, and they began Gray Suit, a hunt for the unknown double agent. But it was not until 2000 that investigators were able to narrow the search. When the FBI paid $7 million to a former Russian intelligence officer for a file on the anonymous mole who called himself B, a file that included an audio recording with a voice that two FBI analysts who knew Mr. Hansen eventually recognized. Using fingerprints, the FBI confirmed that the mole was Mr. Hansen and surveilled him for months, even promoting him to keep better track of him. In February 2001, agents arrested him in Folkestone Park in the Washington suburb of Vienna, Virginia, a few blocks from his home, after he had left classified documents in a garbage bag at a dead drop for his Russian handlers under a wooden footbridge. Mr. Hansen seemed unsurprised at finally being caught. "What took you so long?" he reportedly asked when arrested. Robert Philip Hansen was born on April 18, 1944, in Chicago to Vivian and Howard Hansen, a career Chicago police officer who did intelligence work for the department. An only child who was seen as nerdy and never fit in, Robert had a difficult relationship with his father, who emotionally abused him. He grew up obsessed with James Bond, collecting spy gadgets, and even opening a Swiss bank account. Mr. Hansen received a bachelor's degree in chemistry in 1966 from Knox College in Illinois, where he also studied Russian, but after graduation, he was rejected by the National Security Agency when he applied for a position in cryptography. He enrolled in dentistry school at Northwestern University, but later transferred to the business school where he received a master's degree in business administration. While in dentistry school, he met and married Bonnie Walk, and converted from Lutheran to join her Roman Catholic faith. After a year working at an accounting firm, he took a position with the Chicago Police Department, specializing in forensic accounting. 4 years later, he moved to the FBI. Bright but brittle, Mr. Hansen was said to have burned with resentment that he did not receive the respect and assignments he felt he deserved. With six children in parochial schools, or college, he attributed his decision to spy for Moscow to money, although his reasons were never fully understood. Many of the factors that have motivated or influenced traitors in the past, such as greed, ideology, career disappointments and resentment, and drug and alcohol abuse, do not apply to Hansen or do not fully explain his conduct. a Justice Department Inspector General's report on the case said in 2003. Mr. Hansen led a double life in more ways than one. An active member of the Roman Catholic lay organization, Opus Dei, he presented himself as a religious and committed anti-communist conservative, but according to reports, he also visited strip clubs, allowed a friend to clandestinely watch him having sex with his wife, and engaged in what was said to be a secret but non-sexual relationship with an exotic dancer, whom he plied with gifts and took on an FBI trip to Hong Kong. Mr. Hansen's ability to avoid detection was a signal failure of the American intelligence apparatus. His own brother-in-law, who also worked for the FBI, reported suspicions about Mr. Hansen to the Bureau a decade before his arrest, but the supervisor, he told, had dismissed his concerns. Mr. Hansen was the subject of multiple books and films, including a television movie in 2002, in which he was played by William Hurt, and a full-screen movie called Breach in 2007, in which he was played by Chris Cooper. Hansen was a thicket of paradoxes, a suburban dad and an outwardly devoted family man, who professed to be deeply religious while at the same time betraying family, faith, and country, all and everyone who ever mattered to him. Anne Blackman, a co-author of The Spy Next Door, said on Monday, "For 21 years, through the terms of four presidents and three FBI directors, he fooled them all." Second plane carrying migrants arrives in Sacramento. As California officials accused Florida of shipping migrants to its capital city last week, about 20 more people, mostly from Venezuela, arrived on Monday on the same chartered plane, by Sean Hubler, Edgar Sandoval, and Nicholas Nahimas. A group of Latin American migrants aboard a chartered private plane landed at a small airport in Sacramento on Monday, the second such plane load in 3 days to arrive in California's capital city from an airfield in New Mexico. The group of 20 migrants, 16 from Venezuela, 2 from Colombia, 1 from Nicaragua, and 1 from Mexico, according to California's Justice Department, landed just before 10:30 a.m. Pacific time and was ushered into a room at Sacramento Executive Airport to meet with state law enforcement officials. One of the migrants, David Mata, 28, said he arrived in the United States from Venezuela roughly 2 weeks ago looking for work. Mr. Mata said that he did not know who had orchestrated his trip to Sacramento, but that whoever did had paid for it in its entirety. Another group of migrants arrived on Friday at a different Sacramento airport aboard the same private plane. The authorities in California said those migrants carried papers indicating that their travel had been administered by the Florida Division of Emergency Management and its contractor, Vertol Systems Company, which is based in Florida. It was not immediately clear whether the group that arrived on Monday carried similar papers, but a State Justice Department official said it appeared that the same company and the state of Florida was involved. The official said that two of the men who were on the flight on Friday, both believed to be connected with Vertol, were also on board the plane when it arrived in Sacramento on Monday. Governor Gavin Newsom of California said the state's Attorney General, Rob Bonta, who were both Democrats, have said that they believe Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, a Republican running for president, had arranged for the flight on Friday. So far, Mr. DeSantis has not acknowledged that Florida was responsible, although the details of the incident, including the apparent involvement of Vertol, a private air services and defense contractor, mirror an operation last fall when the governor sent two plane loads of migrants from San Antonio to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. On Monday, a county sheriff in Texas announced that he was recommending that prosecutors file criminal charges pertaining to the Martha's Vineyard flights, although he said nothing about who should be charged. The migrants who were flown to California on Friday began their journey at a shelter in El Paso and were taken from there to a municipal airport about 100 miles away in New Mexico. After they arrived in Sacramento, they were dropped off outside a church building. Over the weekend, Mr. Newsom and other California officials accused Vertol of transporting the group under a false promise of jobs if the migrants agreed to be taken to California. Mr. Bonta said that California state investigators would pursue the possibility of criminal or civil charges against whoever was involved in flying the migrants, calling the action morally bankrupt. The migrants who arrived on Monday, who said their journey too had begun in El Paso, were flown to Sacramento from the same airport in New Mexico, according to the flight tracking website FlightAware. It had been a long trip. Around lunchtime, Stephen Thompson, 62, the owner of a flight school at Sacramento Executive Airport, ordered three Little Caesars pizzas for the migrants. The group could be heard clapping and cheering when the food arrived. Welkendry Rodriguez, 23, said in an interview at the airport that two men and two women had approached him at an El Paso shelter and asked if he wanted to go to California. Mr. Rodriguez, who had survived a dangerous journey through the jungle to reach Texas from Venezuela, said he had eagerly agreed. "It's something you don't wish on others because it's too much, a lot of death," Mr. Rodriguez said of his trek to the United States. He said he was extorted by criminal gangs during the journey. He said the people who offered him the flight to California told him they could help him find work. "I don't know what is their motivation to organize these trips," he said in Spanish. "I don't know if it's political or part of the government. They didn't tell us anything." Mr. Rodriguez added that the people who told him, "If you want to go, go or stay. Nobody is being obligated." Representatives of Mr. DeSantis have not responded to requests for comment. Neither has the Florida Division of Emergency Management, which is running the state's taxpayer-funded program to transport migrants from the southern border to other areas of the United States. Mr. DeSantis appeared on a Fox News radio program on Monday morning, but did not discuss the migrants who had mysteriously appeared in Sacramento. Representatives for Governor Greg Abbott of Texas have said that they were not involved in the trips to California. If Mr. DeSantis is indeed responsible for the latest flights, they offer a taste of how he may use the power of his office to aid his presidential campaign. He is scheduled to hold a fundraiser in Sacramento on June 19th, part of a swing through California to meet wealthy donors. On the campaign trail, he frequently invokes the migrant flights he sent to beautiful Martha's Vineyard, usually to cheers from his audiences, and claims that under President Biden, the nation's southern border has collapsed. "We have opposed illegal immigration by banning sanctuary cities, cracking down on human smuggling, deploying troops to help on the southern border, and even sending illegal aliens to Martha's Vineyard," Mr. DeSantis said last week at a rally outside Des Moines. On Monday, Mr. Newsom, who has clashed repeatedly with Mr. DeSantis, responded to his Florida counterpart on Twitter by calling him pathetic and suggesting that the flights could result in kidnapping charges. Mr. DeSantis has said that he is trying to wake up residents of Democratic cities and states to the border crisis by delivering migrants to their doorsteps. Mr. Abbott of Texas has also sent busloads of migrants to northern cities. Mayor Eric Adams of New York, where tons of thousands of asylum seekers have ended up since last spring, has described his city as being destroyed by the migrant crisis, leading to criticism from other Democrats. Early last month, the federal government ended Title 42, a pandemic-era policy put in place by former President Donald Trump that allowed immigration officials to quickly expel people crossing the border from Mexico. More recently, the Biden administration has enacted new limits on who can apply for asylum in the United States. The surge of migrants in recent months has also left other cities like Washington, Chicago, and Denver scrambling to accommodate them and provide social services. The Martha's Vineyard flights took 49 mostly Venezuelan migrants from San Antonio to the island in September. Vertol contractors gave the migrants a pamphlet written in English and Spanish that suggested help would be waiting for them on their arrival in Massachusetts. Among the promised benefits was assistance finding jobs, housing, food, and clothing. But no one on Martha's Vineyard knew they were coming, leading the migrants to say that they had been lied to. The alleged deception prompted a raft of lawsuits and investigations against Florida and its contractors, including a federal class action lawsuit from the migrants and a criminal investigation by Sheriff Javier Salazar of Bexar County, Texas, a Democrat whose jurisdiction includes San Antonio. In a statement released on Monday, the sheriff's office said it believed felony and misdemeanor charges of unlawful restraint were warranted, although it did not name the people it believed should be charged. At this time, the case is being reviewed by the DA's office, the statement said. Any decision by prosecutors is likely several weeks away. Those earlier flights also drew a state court lawsuit from State Senator Jason Pizzo of Florida, a Democrat who argued, among other claims, that Florida had violated existing state law by transporting migrants if found in Texas rather than Florida. In response, Mr. DeSantis called state legislators to a special session in February, where they passed a new law to allow Florida to transport migrants from anywhere within the United States. Later, the legislature authorized $12 million for the program as part of the state's new law cracking down on undocumented immigrants. Mr. Pizzo agreed to dismiss his suit after the new law passed, but in an interview on Monday, he said he believed the sole point of resuming the flights was to further Mr. DeSantis's political ambitions. "This is beyond theater," Mr. Pizzo said. "These are not bad people. They're not criminals. They are refugees and asylum seekers." Florida spent more than $1.5 million on the migrant flight program last year. The Martha's Vineyard flights cost $615,000. That same month, the state paid Vertol $950,000 for flights that were supposed to go to Delaware and Illinois, state records show, but those flights never happened. Other records showed that Mr. DeSantis's top aides were intimately involved in planning the flights to Martha's Vineyard, even traveling to San Antonio to help arrange them. In the meantime, recruiters have been scouring the streets of El Paso, according to interviews with migrants at a shelter near the International Bridge to Mexico. Maria Cova, 42, an immigrant from Venezuela, said on Monday that she was outside the shelter at the Sacred Heart Church last week when a woman approached and offered her a free trip to California. The woman did not give her name or say who she worked for. Ms. Cova said she turned her down because she was planning to travel to Chicago. Still, the woman insisted, telling her she could help change Ms. Cova's immigration court date to California. "She told me that we did not have to worry about anything, that she would be giving us a free ride to California," Ms. Cova recalled. "She was very friendly, a little too friendly, I thought. Something about her," she added, "did not feel right." Ancient human relatives buried their dead in caves, new theory claims. Homo naledi, despite having tiny brains, may have lit fires and decorated walls around the graves of their dead, according to controversial new research by Carl Zimmer. In 2015, scientists reported an astonishing discovery from deep inside a South African cave. More than 1,500 fossils of an ancient hominin species that had never been seen before. The creatures, called Homo naledi, were short with long arms, curved fingers, and a brain about one-third the size of a modern human's. They lived around the time the first humans were roaming Africa. Now, after years of analyzing the surfaces and sediments of the elaborate underground cave, the same team of scientists is making another splashy announcement. Homo naledi, despite their tiny brains, buried their dead in graves. They lit fires to illuminate their way down the cave, and they marked the graves with engravings on the walls. Lee Berger, a paleoanthropologist at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg and the leader of the project, said that the discovery that a small-brained hominin did such human-like things was profound. "It suggests that big brains are not essential for sophisticated kinds of thinking," he said, "such as making symbols, cooperating on dangerous expeditions, or even recognizing death." "This is the Star Trek moment," he said. "You go out, you meet a species, it's not human, but it's equally complex to humans. What do you do? That's our moment right now." But a number of experts on ancient engravings and burials said that the evidence did not yet support these extraordinary conclusions about Homo naledi. The cave evidence found so far could have a range of other explanations, they said. The skeletons might have been merely left on the cave floor, for example, and the charcoal and engravings found in the cave might have been left by modern humans who entered long after Homo naledi became extinct. "It seems that the narrative is more important than the facts," said Maxime Aubert, an archaeologist at Griffith University in Australia. Dr. Berger will describe the findings as a scientific meeting on Monday, and three papers detailing the evidence will be released by the journal eLife. The studies are currently under peer review, a journal spokeswoman said, and those reviews will be posted publicly when they are finished. The Homo naledi remains were discovered in 2013 by two South African spelunkers exploring the Rising Star Cave. Dr. Berger organized an expedition into the complex system of chambers and tunnels, which extends for miles underground. "When you're in there, it's like you're on a different planet," said Tobogo Makabela, a geologist at the University of Johannesburg, who joined the team in 2014. The researchers found a wealth of bones, but reaching them required some risky caving. Some passageways were so tight that only smaller members of the team could fit through. All told, the researchers have found bones from at least 27 individuals. It seemed unlikely to Dr. Berger and his colleagues that they could have simply washed into the deep recesses of the cave. In their 2015 report, the researchers suggested that Homo naledi brought the bodies there deliberately but left them on the cave floor rather than burying them, an act archaeologists call funerary caching. This was still a provocative claim, given how primitive Homo naledi appeared. Dr. Berger and his colleagues argued that the species belonged to a lineage that split from our own ancestors over 2 million years ago. While our lineage grew tall and gained a big brain, theirs did not. At first, the scientists thought the fossils were spread out evenly across the chamber floors, but as they dug up more sediment in 2018, they observed that two fairly complete skeletons rested inside oval depressions. And it didn't look as if the skeletons had formed the depressions by sinking into the sediment. For example, an orange layer of mud surrounded the ovals, but it was not inside of them. Along the edges, the break looked clean. This finding, as well as other lines of evidence, have led Dr. Makabela and his colleagues to now conclude that the remains have been buried. "All of them seem to paint the same picture," he said. Until now, only humans were known to bury their dead, and the oldest known human grave dates back 78,000 years. Homo naledi lived much earlier than that. Dr. Makabela said their fossils were at least 240,000 years old and might be as much as 500,000 years old. The scientists also found bits of charcoal, burned bones of turtles and rabbits, and soot on the cave walls near the fossils. They proposed that Homo naledi used glowing coals to light their way into the caves and brought wood or some other fuel to burn fires. They might have cooked the animals as a meal or perhaps as a ritual. As these new discoveries came to light, Dr. Berger decided that he had to take a look for himself at one of the chambers, known as Denaledi, that contained a purported grave. He had to lose 55 pounds before he could fit through the passageway. Last July, he was ready for the journey. Dr. Berger went in alone and examined the fossils. As he made his way out, he passed a pillar. On its side, he noticed a set of hashtag-like grooves etched into the hard surface. "Getting out was harder than getting in. I almost died," Dr. Berger said, but managed to escape with a torn rotator cuff. Two members of the team, Augustin Fuentes of Princeton University and John Hawks of the University of Wisconsin, were waiting for him in the adjoining chamber. Dr. Berger showed them photos of the grooves he had taken. The two scientists immediately went to their phones and pulled up the same image, an engraving in a cave in Gibraltar made by Neanderthals. It was strikingly similar to what Dr. Berger had just seen. Based on the growing number of fossils scientists are finding in Rising Star, Dr. Fuentes said it looks as if Homo naledi may have visited the cave for perhaps hundreds of generations, moving together into the dark depths to bury their dead and mark the place with art. This type of cultural practice, he argued, would have demanded language of some sort. "You don't do that without some complex communication," he said. But Maria Martinen Torres, the director of Spain's National Research Center on Human Evolution, said that such speculations were premature based on the evidence presented so far. Hypotheses need to be built on what we have, not what we guess, she said. Dr. Martina Torres considered funerary caching more likely than burials, pointing out that the oval depressions did not contain full skeletons in complete alignment. If Homon and Leedy brought the bones into the cave and left them on the floor, the bones could have become separated as the bodies decomposed. Still, I think the possibility of having funerary caching with this antiquity is already stunning, she said. I'm highly optimistic that they have burials, but the jury is still out, said Michael Petraglia, the director of the Australian Research Center for Human Evolution. Dr. Petraglia wanted to see more detailed analysis of the sediment and other kinds of evidence before judging whether the ovals were burials. The problem is that they're ahead of the science, he said. And Paul Petit, an archaeologist at Durham University in England, said it was possible that Homo naledi did not bring the bodies in, either for caching or burying. The bodies may have washed in. I'm not convinced that the team have demonstrated that this was a deliberate burial, he said. As for the engravings and the fires, experts said it wasn't clear that Homo naledi was responsible for them. It was possible they were the work of modern humans who came into the caves thousands of years later. The whole thing is unconvincing, to say the least, said Joa Zilau, an archaeologist at the University of Barcelona. One way to test those possibilities would be to collect samples from the engravings, charcoal and soot, in order to estimate their age. Dr. Hawks said that these experiments were on the team's to-do list, but could take years because there were so many samples to test. Rather than waiting, Dr. Hawks said the team decided to present its data now and start a conversation with other scientists about how to proceed. For me, it's much more important to document and to share than to be right, Dr. Hawks said. If the researchers are right, the findings will challenge some of the most important assumptions about human evolution. Humans and Neanderthals have huge brains compared with those of earlier hominins, and paleoanthropologists have long assumed that the bigger size brought major benefits. There would have to be some upside to outweigh the problems, evolutionarily speaking, of having big brains. They require a lot of extra calories to fuel, and an infant's large heads put mothers at risk of dying during childbirth. One benefit of a big brain might be complex thinking. Neanderthals have left behind an impressive record of cooperative hunting, tool use, and other skills. And modern humans make symbols, use language, and perform other feats of brain power. If a homonym like Homo naledi could make engravings and dig graves, it would mean brain size was not essential to complex thought, said Dietrich Stout, a neuroscientist at Emory University who is not involved in the studies. I think the interesting question moving forward is what exactly big brains are needed for, Dr. Stout said. The most common eating disorder in the U.S. is also the least understood. Binge eating disorder entered the Diagnostic Manual on Mental Health Conditions 10 years ago. It's still getting overlooked, by Danny Bloom. At 2 or 3 a.m., David Tidro would hide the empty cardboard cereal box, shoving it into the bottom of the trash can or the back of the cupboard, where his wife wouldn't notice it. Mr. Tidro was in his 60s and retired, and he often slept until the afternoon so he could stay up late, after everyone else had gone to bed. During frantic late-night bursts, he would eat an entire box of cereal, oatmeal squares, frosted mini-wheats, whatever was around, and then dispose of the evidence. He had eaten compulsively throughout his life, he said, but after months of going through a box of cereal each night, he decided to try to get help. In 2016, he left his home in North Carolina to seek treatment for what he thought was food addiction at a hospital in Wisconsin that specialized in eating issues. He was diagnosed with binge eating disorder. I had no earthly idea that it even existed, he said, but the diagnosis gave him a sense of relief. There was an explanation for this. Binge eating disorder is the most common eating disorder in the United States. Exact numbers vary, but according to the National Institute of Mental Health, nearly 3% of the U.S. population has had binge eating disorder at some point in their lives, more than double the reported numbers for bulimia nervosa and anorexia. Yet the disorder is under-discussed and under-recognized by both the general public and those in the medical field, partly because they don't know about the diagnosis or its potential severity. Often people will exhibit symptoms for decades before receiving a diagnosis, said Cynthia Bullock, the founding director of the University of North Carolina's Center of Excellence for Eating Disorders. For so long, they've been told things like, oh, this is just emotional eating, or you're out of control, or it's because you have no willpower, or gluttony's a sin, or whatever these things are that people explain it away, without realizing that they have a treatable condition, she said. What is binge eating disorder? Binge eating disorder is a relative newcomer to the world of diagnosable mental health conditions. It entered the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which clinicians and researchers use to classify mental health conditions, 10 years ago this month. At the time, the diagnosis was fairly controversial, said Dr. B. Timothy Walsh, who led a group that recommended changes to existing criteria for eating disorders and proposed adding new ones to that edition of the DSM. Some thought that it was pathologizing normality, he said, and did not understand how it was different from ordinary overeating. But the behaviors of binge eating disorder are distinct, he said. A person with the condition has, on average, at least one binge episode per week for 3 months or longer, during which the person eats an objectively large amount of food in a short period of time. Three or more main courses in one sitting, for example, and crucially feels a loss of control and struggles to stop eating. This isn't like I had an extra piece of pizza that I wish I didn't eat. This is I ate several pizzas, in this discrete amount of time, said Dr. Holly Peek, the assistant medical director of the Clareman Eating Disorder Center at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. People with binge eating disorder also tend to eat more quickly than usual during an episode. Many also eat in secret and grapple with guilt, said Kelly Allison, the director of the Center for Weight and Eating Disorders at the University of Pennsylvania. This concludes the reading of the New York Times for today. Your reader for today has been Dawn Flickinger. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions concerning this program, please feel free to call us at area code 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening, and now please stay tuned for continued programming on Radio Live.